Blog Talk Radio.
Ain't no stopping us now.
three words. Tell this nation what we are talking about. Tell these words, you don't need to have a great vocabulary to utter. You don't need to have a philosophical bent to grasp. There are three little words. We want to let the world know that these words describe what we mean and what we are determined to do about racial injustice. One is the word all. We don't want some of our rights. We don't want a few token handouts here and there. We want all of our rights. There are some people who say that we need to go back to Africa. And then there are some others who tell people in the South, leave the South. You can't be free, so get out. But down in Alabama, in Mississippi, in Georgia, South Carolina, we are saying something else. We want all of our rights, and we want all of our rights here in Alabama, in Mississippi, in South Carolina. Then there's a third word, it is the word now. We're not willing to wait 100 years for our rights. No, we are not willing to wait another 25 years for our rights. We can hear voices telling us to slow up. We can hear voices telling us to cool up. Our only answer in conversation turn must be that we have cooled off too long, and if we keep cooling off, we'll end up in a deep freeze. We must go on and say, no, what we are saying to this nation is that we want all of our rights. We want them here, and we want all of them not next year, not next week, but we want them now, at this hour. This is what we're saying.
What your life can truly be. Shining star for you to see. What your life can truly be.
Network.
We all live.
We in your speakers.
And on your mind.
On your mind.
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
We on time.
Yes, this is Lenny Williams. I'm out here in Oakland, California.
I'm Lisa Lay. I'm on payment with the NWA, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E.
It's Just Will, Black Pearl Entertainment artist, newly signed to I Am Jesus Records. You're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., CEO. Coming to you live, this is business, so pay attention.
Yo, it's your boy LV the Slap Thing, and I'm over here chilling with my guy, The Plug, Don Jr., CEO, Entertainment Worldwide Network Radio. You dig?
What's good, homie? This your boy, Big D.
It's your folk, Checking Traps.
This your peach, Captain Mac.
I let your boy, Bossalina.
It's your boy, Brick Boy Rico.
It's your boy, Joe Dirt.
Hey, yo, what up? It's your boy, Buddha, a.k.a. Buddy Mouse.
Yo, what's good? This is Vic Percy Jones.
And Big Cell is now in your area.
Yo, this your boy, Mr. Hamilton.
It's your girl, Lady Duet.
It's just Rich Gates.
This your bro, JT, Mr. Guaranteed the Rick.
Yo, this your dude, Insane G.
What up? This your boy, Jihad, a.k.a. J Hood.
Yo, this your folks, Young Birds.
Yo, this your folk, GB Cooley.
Yo, this is Mike G Jungle. Hey, what it do? It's your boy, Size Money.
This your boy, Big Chad Domingo.
Bye-bye. Salute the big dog.
This your boy, Jay Futuristic.
This your folk, Lil Raheem. You did.
I am Geronimo Beals. Off the deep end. Getting blessings. Wise Life Records. And you're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., the CEO, coming to you live.
Hey, what it do? This is Charlie Boy, the Versatile Charlie.
You're listening to the hottest radio station.
Are you ready to be inspired, uplifted, enlightened, and entertained? Judge Joe Brown is an all-American judge, lawyer, and television personality. Judge Joe Brown was raised in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, California. Overcoming the harsh streets of L.A., he graduated at the top of his class from Dorsey High School. He then went on to earn his bachelor's degree in political science at UCLA. Judge Joe Brown is a member of the Phi Alpha fraternity and became the first African-American prosecutor in Memphis, Tennessee. He then opened his own practice before becoming a judge on the state criminal court of Shelby County, Tennessee. Judge Joe Brown was then thrusted into the national spotlight for sitting over James Earl's last appeal for race conviction for the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He then caught the attention of producers of Judge Judy and is now the arbiter of his own arbitration-based reality court TV show that has been recorded for over 16 years. This show is syndicated on Bounce and available to millions of homes across America. Judge Joe Brown has been on a mission to educate the leaders of the future and has started a movement titled SAG Pants Equals a SAG Mind. This is a call to action. Let's talk and change the world. Judge Joe Brown is ready to speak at your next event. Follow Judge Joe Brown at Judge Joe Brown TV on Twitter. This message has been brought to you by 2Deep, owner of KFSM Radio and Bloody Rain Productions, and Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team. Contact 2Deep at 337-936-5176 or Pastor Don Jr. at 818-358-5722.
The NEO Project is a business network collective of professional CEOs, community leaders, doctors, recording artists, label owners, lawyers, judges, business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major connections across the globe. For more information, visit www.myprojectneo.org or call 800-249-8830. We have a live conference call, Join in the Conversation, hosted by Dr. Rev Robinson Sr. and Dr. Winborn. Share your ideas about growing your business. New ideas, featured partners, video promo, social media, exposure, rotation, profit sharing, meetups at your establishment. Join the conference call on Blog Talk Radio Thursday and Friday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Sunday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Live Talk with Eva. Call 347-857-1311. Press 1 to speak on freeconferencecall.com. Saturday, 12 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Call into 515-604-9642. Access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, hashtag T-Mobile, or Boost Mobile, call 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, T-Mobile, or Boost Mobile, dial 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. Financial consulting and investments, call DSNR Consultants LLC Corporate Office, 914-363-9007. Text 518-866-7605. Email RevRunRobinson, RevRun11@gmail.com. Shout out to Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and Keisha Miss, CEO, and the 300 Elite members, also 3 Max and a Nerd, and Andrea's Talent Management.
Fashion is so seductive, live.com. Log on to soseductivelive.com. So Seductive Live has the best apparel from Gucci, Prada, Fendi, Guess, Rolex, Nike, Tiana Michelle, True Religion, Louis Vuitton.
Greetings, I'm Miss K, CEO and founder of So Seductive Shoes and Fashion. I started my company to keep you informed. Log on to soseductivelive.com. I believe in fashion, so Seductive is fun and needs to be seen. I want to inspire people just like you. I want someone to look at me and say, because of you, I didn't give up. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I am Miss K, CEO and founder of So Seductive Shoes and Fashion. You can find me on your favorite social network at Keisha Miss CEO. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com.
There's a lot to learn in the music business, and without a teacher, it gets even harder and very costly. Introducing the Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint. Don Jr., CEO of the Entertainment Worldwide Network, has put together a detailed book to take your career to the next level in the entertainment business. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint will teach you the do's and don'ts of the entertainment industry, starting from the beginning to the end. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint covers the topics of business plan, logo design, CD design layout, sales, radio airplay, CD marketing strategy, massive emailing, CD sales one sheet, press kit, media kit, online media kit, internet marketing, MP3 online distribution, hip-hop blog sites, hip-hop magazines, hip-hop DVDs, mixtapes, street teams, music publishing and royalties, music lawyers,
tour bookings, and more. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint is available only by contacting Don Jr., CEO, at 818-358-5722 or email donjrceo@gmail.com.
Do you need more exposure? Do you need more fans? Are you planning to be wealthy and successful in business? The 365 Days of Radio campaign is a business training program teaching you how to build your brand, business, product, or service. How to meet and network with people in other cities. How to make connections with other business owners. And how to talk about your business on an open platform. All the tools you need before you speak to investors, advertisers, and or sponsors. Are you ready to receive money and make it to the next level? Education is the key to success. And experience is the best teacher. Learn from the comfort of your own personal remote location. The 365-day radio campaign is a business training program. For business training, tuition, schedules, and fees, please call Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and the winning team at 818-358-5722. That's right, Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team at 818-358-5722.
Here we are once again, Friday night. It is the Black Business Billionaires Network Club, and I am your host. Some say Rev Ron, some say Dr. Robinson, some say Mr. Electric, some say the nut, the crazy man. Maybe I shouldn't add those things to it as well. That's not really nice, Ron. Anyway, we're here at the Black Business Billionaires Network Club, and we always bring you news and current events and situation that's occurring in our country here. Big news in Nashville, Tennessee. Three lawmakers were being put on the block to be expelled, and basically because they rally against they were rallying against gun violence in Nashville, Tennessee, as well as we know that six people were gunned down in Nashville, Tennessee, in a private Christian school. And this shocked not only Tennessee, but this shocked the whole world. It's just shocked. It definitely was a national shock in America. Three adults and three children were killed. And so there was a big rally the other day, school children in the tens of thousands marched upon the Capitol in Tennessee, requesting that the lawmakers put more stringent laws against the purchase of guns, the usage of guns, and especially the AK-15, which was used to kill people. It's a high-powered rifle, very high-powered rifle. And so they got on the floor, what they call the floor of the House of Representatives floor, the congressional session of the House of Representatives floor in Nashville, Tennessee, and they got out the well, and they had bullhorns because they were being blocked. Their mics were being cut off. They were being blocked from discussing with the House legislation gun control, gun reform bills. And in Nashville, Tennessee, like most southern states, they pride themselves on the Second Amendment, the right to carry, and they want people to have guns, and even some have suggested on the teachers, gun for guns, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth type of thing, on the teachers so that they could be able to shoot. And there's more guns lead to more types of violence. So these three lawmakers, Justin Pierce, Justin Jones, and Gloria Johnson, got together and decided to rally on the floor of the Nashville, Tennessee House of Representatives against not having any bill to protect purchases of guns, having a more stringent investigative process, have more extensive application, have a more evaluation of the persons that carry guns, and have a ban on assault weapons. And so this sparked the large majority, let's say this, the large majority of Nashville, Tennessee lawmakers are GOP. They're Republican, conservative, and they do not want to discuss, or they do not want to control the Second Amendment. They do not want to discuss eliminating and banning assault weapons, particularly the AK-15, which can blow your head off, and it have blown children's head off in violent situations that we have experienced in the past. It's a very high-powered rifle. People do not need AK-15s. They do not need high-powered rifles. They use it in the military. There's a purpose and a reason for it, and there's a good training that they get for the usage. But the average Joe do not need a that type of weapon. They do not need a weapon like that just can do damage and can shoot X amount of bullets in minutes, 80 bullets in a minute. So what person needs that? And so we're looking for sensible gun laws that would protect people from getting endangered by other people who are mentally challenged or whatever, from purchasing guns, people from having high-powered rifles so that they cannot do extreme damage as well. But in Nashville, Tennessee, Southern State, GOP, conservative, Republican, held majority of the House of Representatives and the government do not want any level of gun control, any level of sensible background checks, any level of restrictions on purchasing of guns. And so these three lawmakers, Pearson and Johnson, got on the House floor and requested that they be heard. They got bullhorns and they just got on the floor and they took over the floor. And it ended up that Pearson and Johnson, Gloria Johnson, who's a white woman, Justin Pearson, and Justin Jones are black lawmakers, some of the youngest black lawmakers in Tennessee. And they were expelled, and Mrs. Gloria Johnson, who was white, was spared. She kept her job by one vote margin. And so the irony is racism. They choose to expel charges that they had on the white woman lawmaker. And so we see another disparity in injustice in America. If we don't realize that it's necessary that we get our independence and sovereignty so that we can self-judge on all levels of governmental policy, government procedures, logistics, constitution, jurisdictions, we have to see that we need this independence so we can be self-sufficient and self-evaluating, because the odds of you getting any kind of rights when you're only 13% of the population against 60% of the population, which is Caucasian, you're not going to win. You're not going to win. It's going to be very, very extremely hard for you to win. So if you're separate and apart, which would be good for them as well as good for us, you can take advantage of the opportunity that's afforded you. You know, so here we are again, hundreds of years later, and we're dealing with the ugliness of racism, the ugliness of racism, and we have to avoid that at all costs. We have to definitely put that to rest. We have to definitely look at changing some conditions. We'll get into a subject matter in a few. I'm going to play a review, if you will, a study, statistical facts from Attorney Jeffrey Robinson, and what he has to say about the history in this country and the injustices African American people and all that they have faced. And so here we are now. Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, 6 people get killed, 1 black person and 5 white people, 3 adults and 3 children. And they still do not want to pass sensible legislation and laws against assault weapons, against people who have mental conditions, people who belong to antisocial groups buying guns. At least stop them from buying high powerful weapons, you know, stop them from buying high powerful weapons. So here we are discussing this again. And in the interim of all that we've been going through, they choose to suspend these legislators in Nashville, Tennessee, Justin Pierce and Justin Jones. And Mrs. Johnson came up for motion from the House of Representatives in Nashville, Tennessee. The white woman, Mrs. Gloria Jones, she survived by 1 vote to not get expelled. And the 2 black lawmakers, the young black lawmakers, the youngest in the state, had been expelled from Nashville, the Nashville congressional representation of their district, their state representatives in Nashville, Tennessee, basically saying that they violated rules and regulations of going on the floor at the well and protesting gun violence, protesting with the young people, tens of thousands of young people who headed to the Capitol, protest the usage of guns and the use of high powerful guns like AK-15 that can barely just blow a kid's head off, and it have been done. So this continued to be the fight, but the thing is, the white woman was spared and the 2 black legislative officers were expelled from practicing, and they don't want them to come back. This are the continuances of the racism. These people are so bound to their ignorance and their power that they're willing to let their kids, because majority of people that died was white, so they're willing to let their kids and their family die because they do not want to act on sensible gun laws thing. This is historical. They expelled 2 black lawmakers for standing up for their districts and fighting on behalf of their districts and fighting on behalf of the people of Tennessee as well as the people in the USA. And if we continue to sit back and say nothing and let these people continue with this ignorance, we will never move forward. There's so much injustices being passed by attorneys and district attorneys and lawyers and judges, racist behavior, institutionalized and personalized, and it have to be dealt with at some point. There has to be a way to come out of this, and the only way to do it if you give indigenous people sovereignty and independence so that they can be self-sufficient, self-directing, and self-reliant. Point where we're separate but equal, and we have a separate mission to continue to fight for that which is right. And you have to keep coming on Black Business Billionaires Network Club. You have to keep coming on Experiencing Spiritual Unity and Meditation with Dr. Benyamin. You have to keep coming on Sundays. You come on Saturdays is Dr. Benyamin Experiencing Spiritual Unity. On Sunday, it's the lovely Sadie Gomez, the Ethiopian Wealth Federation Common Incorporated, the Women's Auxiliary with Ms. Sadie Gomez. Monday is Black Alice in Wonderland, at the same time, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard New York City time. You have finances with Mr. Eugene Bias as well. You have self-improvement and changing lives and expanding expectations with Dr. Yvette Kinnerick on Wednesdays, and so forth and so on. And you have the reggae beat show with reggae music and history on Thursday nights with Rouse Alrick. You have to keep coming on these shows. You have to keep listening to these shows. You have to keep participating and getting involved, because history is repeating itself in America, and we are going back to the 1900s, the 1800s, the 1600s, the 1700s. And it's time that we have to change those conditions. We're going backwards because we're not going forward. They're eliminating, they call Black history CRT. Black history has been separate from American history. They act like it's a separate thing going on. And so maybe we should be separate. Maybe that's the best way. It'll save lives, save white lives and black lives. So maybe we do have to separate ourselves from the mainstream system and be self-sufficient, independent, and sovereign. Because we definitely not come to a conclusion of a common denominator where all people can be treated the same. At the same time, everybody prosper and be in good health and go forward. But we cannot get a consensus on that behavior, and we cannot come together. So the only thing is, when you come together, you'll be separate. There's no in between. There's no lukewarm position. Either you're for the righteousness or you're not for the righteousness, to see how we can change some of these conditions as we go forward. So I would love to see what the person who wants to change the conditions of this country and the directions and how we as a people can change. I want to hear from the audience, what can we do, me, you, individually, to change the conditions? Yes, we need to pray to God. Yes, we need to go to church. Yes, we need to read the Bible. Yes, we need to understand all history. But work, faith without works is dead. You can have all the faith in the world. If you don't exercise it, it don't mean nothing. We have to get out and get up. And I'm revitalizing an organization called the African American Independence Day. And we're going to have a budget, and we're going to move forward to revise the laws that need to be implemented, anti-poverty and anti-poverty programs, okay, developing economic opportunities in the community as we move forward. There got to be a change. And I'm taking my responsibility. Are you taking yours? Everybody got to take their responsibility to this change. Everybody got to be physically, mentally, socially, politically, spiritually involved in changing these conditions, because if we don't, like the Bible said, live together in unity like brothers and sisters, or die separately like fools. And it seems to me that's what we're doing. But what can we do on a physical level? How can we come together as a community? and change this racist society, the laws, change the Constitution, put things into the place that will protect us, because apparently we're not protected under this law. And we have to be. And joining with us today, as we see here on in the studio, is the man himself, Dr. Benjamin Bridges, from Experiencing Spiritual Unity and Meditation, which comes on Saturday, 7 to 9, same number, 347-857-1311. And he'll be on, and you can continue to get support and help on his show. And we want you, sir, and you, ma'am, to go on the show and listen to it and participate in it every Saturday. We want you to go on Sunday to Sadie Gomez's show, Monday to Queen Amina's show, and then Tuesday to financial literacy with Eugene Bias, and then the other shows on the other days as well. Wednesday, Proven Lives and Shaping Destinies with Dr. Kinnerick, and Thursday night, the Brass Beat, the Reggae Show, Music and History, the Ralph Arix, and so forth back here on Friday nights, like tonight, with the Black Business Billionaires Network Club, yours truly, Dr. Ron Robinson, Reverend Ron, Mr. Electric, here I am. But we got to find a change, people. We can't continue this way. It's disruptive and destructive, inconsiderate, and there's no consistency. The history is repeating itself, and not for a good reason, for a bad reason. And we can't continue to go on this way. So we're going to open up the mic of the man himself, as I said, Dr. Benjamin Bridges from Experiencing Spiritual Unity and Meditation. Tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m., he'll give us a little taste of what's going to happen. Everybody, I would admonish you to tune in and listen to the brother. Well, let's give him a nice hand and welcome him to the studio.
Thank you, my brother, for inviting me on the show. And, yeah, man, you brought up a serious issue. You know, when you're talking about these guns and, you know, how the politicians are, you know, not trying to say, hey, you know, we heard so many kids are getting killed and even adults right now. And seeing that, you know, this, you know, political, you know, law thing has changed for you to get easy access to the guns, we better change it and see what we could do to, you know, end all of this. But they're not even saying that. What's being said is that they don't see nothing wrong with all these people getting killed, and why should we stop? So they was even talking with Biden, and Biden at one point, I don't know if he changed his mind, but the last time I heard from what he had said on television on the news, he was saying that he was backing up the situation with, you know, how people should be able to get easy access to the guns, whether they be youth or adults, it doesn't make a difference. And, you know, that was really crazy. But yet, you know, as a politician, many times they don't even care. Sometimes these guys who own these gun companies, they're willing to give you some money under the table if you would allow them to open up, you know, things politically so that they could sell a lot more guns to a lot more people. And sometimes that's how it works, you know. But the bottom line is, I can't say I know exactly what it is, but the bottom line is, I mean, just common sense-wise, when you see all these additional people since this new gun law has been passed and all these people are being killed and the politicians like Biden aren't really stepping up to the plate to stop this, it lets you know where he's really coming from. Because like I said before, many times it's called the game of politics. You know, people tell you that they're really interested in helping your community and they really want to see about, you know, some great things happening for you. And, you know, but you just have to vote for me so I could get into office. And then when you get them into office, you know, you find out that some of them won't even throw you crumbs off the table. you know, and then others, you know, will throw you just a few crumbs, and that's basically it. But as far as them really following through and doing what they said they're going to do, it's not going to happen. So in regards to relying on politics to really be the cure for really healing and changing our community, we can't totally, you know, focus on that. What we need to do as a people is, as you said earlier, come together in unity to see what we can do. And that means that we even have to overcome many of the brick walls that we have placed up, you know, over the years that are separating us from working with one another now, you know. But the bottom line is we as a people are the ones that have to come together and start to see ourselves as a people whose lives do matter, whether it's our children, whether it's our adults. It doesn't make a difference. Both of their lives do matter, adults' lives and children's lives. And if they do matter, then you should do something about protecting their lives and improving their lives. And these are things that definitely need to be done. But the bottom line is, if we as a people don't really step up to the plate to do nothing about it, then that's what's going to happen. But anyway, right now, unfortunately, my battery on my phone is all the way down. And I have to say adios amigos on this, but I'm glad that I had a chance to just give my opinion on what's happening with this terrible situation.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Always, always have good food for thought for us. Always have good spiritual upliftment for us. And we appreciate you and people. Tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard New York City time, expressing spiritual unity and meditation. We got the Benjamin Bridges. I suggest you, ma'am, you, sir, go on the show tomorrow and listen for more great information from him. Thank you so much, brother. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to open up the man himself, Ronald A. We're going to open up his mic and hear from him on this subject of what we do, you know, in these times, what action we could take to change some of this stuff.
Good evening, Hotep.
Hotep. Gary Bird.
I agree with Dr. Ben, and every time that we have a killing, a mass murder, you know, we do jump to support and help to support those lives that we lost. And lately, there have been a lot of white lives, you know, and large percentage of white people are committing these crimes. But I say in our neighborhoods, a lot of killing, robbing, you know, attacking, you know, in our communities, suicide, you know, suicide by cop, you know, and so on. We need to also address that because it's definitely a psychological problem in our community due to the prison system, due to fatherless children and motherless as well. The system raising children till they're 18 and then they're put out in the street or they're in jail. And when they come out, where do they have to go? They have to do. That's a major problem. And if we can solve or help that problem, that would cure that problem. And it takes a projected interest, an attitude, awakening, rather than every time we look on the news, we see what these kids do, our kids do, and there's little support. As I'm looking at listening to city council and state representatives on and so on, on YouTube and that, people are always asking for the closing of Rikers, all right? They're asking for medical care, mental health care, you know, and so on, and they're not getting with all the money that we put in this system. So when they come out, they come out worse than they went in, you know? And this is an issue. When you have no place to go, nobody out here helping you, supporting you, and there are organizations that do a lot. What do? To survive, you steal, you rob. You know, and sometimes you find yourself in a situation where you're killing people. And now it's killing people just because they can. And I'm seeing all of that on the news as well. So I used to be in a position to say, well, you know, like at this time in my life, you know, and some of my associates, you know, what we can do, we've done what we can do. I said, no, we haven't, because nothing's changed. You know, each one teach one as well, but if the youth there, and most people are youth to me, that are teaching one, that are teaching one another, through their relationship with elders that have sense and have a word or support, we can do this. You know, but if we're sitting back and complaining all the time and having the living room conversations about this and that, what we can do and what we can't do, we're not getting out there. Most of us are not getting out there on the front line to help these people, and those people that are doing it, are doing that, we don't hear about. We just hear about all the negative. And that's why I listen to the city, New York City Council, because there's a lot of women, many women that have been in the battle for years. And when I look at them, they look like my grandchildren. They're so young. But you got to remember, Martin Luther King was young. Abernathy, these guys were in their 20s, and they're fighting, you know, and down south they're fighting, you know, against dogs and water hoses. The only difference now is that the dogs have changed their face, you know, and there's no water hoses. So there's nothing new under the sun, nothing that has changed. We get information faster, you know. We get online and put hate messages online faster because we're afraid to confront the people that are giving us issues or that we disagree with, you know, and so on. So it's about coming together, you know, and not as individuals. There are many organizations out there. I only ask organizations to leave and follow me or follow us. Just join us. We have a common goal, you know, to clean up our people. And in cleaning up our people, we'll clean up this society. And that's my feeling and my personal opinion on the matter.
Well, the Bible says the house divided against itself shall not stand. Hopefully the American government, the legislators, the congressmen, the senators, the council, city reps, the advocates, you know, all the positions, political, socioeconomic positions, all the political positions, people will see the self-destructive nature of things as they are. And this is not new to us. This has been going on for the last hundreds of years. If we do not decide people, first of all, you got to start checking out your legislators when they're running for the job. You got to start getting these people bio and read their bio and see what club they belong to, what organizations they participate, you know, give them, they get to go to their social media. their Facebook, their Twitters, their Instagrams, and check out the ideology, how they feel about certain things. That tells you a lot about a person. And so we have to stop doing our due diligence as voters. But you want to put somebody in there that's going to have your best interest at heart. But it's so far what I can see, people are putting people in there at random, and we don't know the method they use to get the person there. But the person is there, you know. So if we are going to see change, make change, or have change, we're going to have to step in and get involved. Like John Lewis said, get in some good trouble. So there's so much going on now in America. There's so much discourse and disruption and political, social, economic depravity. People are dying of starvation. People are dying of drugs and alcoholism. People are dying of disease and sickness. And it's a tragedy. And so we have to come together and stop some of this nonsense. Really, really stop this nonsense and change some of these legislators, change some of these people in office. And though that new laws that coming in can prevail and be set up, but make sure that they're positive laws that's going to change the lives and the conditions of us as a people here in the United States of America. And so, this radio program and what we're trying to achieve is change, physical change. We want people to get involved in that change. We want people to participate in that change. And so we're asking you, sir, ma'am, get involved in your community, civic duties, community duties, citizen duties. Get involved with your neighbors and your friends in making change, passing laws, getting things to the point where they can be set up better than what they are. So we can do better, and we have to do better, and we got to find a common denominator, common ground to do better. So whatever that is for you, it's going to be extremely important that we find a way to come together as human beings for the betterment of humanity. Because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves in a tremendous problem. Tremendous, tremendous. So I'm asking you, ma'am, and you, sir, that you come into this fruition, come to this program with a heart and mind to want to make some change. I had so many people who missed the liturgy and the historical facts of slavery in America with Mr. Attorney Jeff Robinson. And so many people have been begging me to get it back again, and which is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get it back again for you. And we're going to listen to some of it, and we're going to evaluate some and talk to some historians about some things as well. Listen in.
If you have ever owned a slave, please raise your hand. Slavery is not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't cause it. It's not our responsibility, but it is our shared history. And when we try and turn it into something that it's not, when we try and make more light of it than it was, then we are denying who we really are, and we are impeding our ability to truly move forward as a community or as a nation.
in most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people were treated as family?
That's basically the way it was down South.
So what I want to talk to you about is part of the ugliness of our history. I want all of us to understand just how we laid the groundwork to own other human beings as property.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. 41 of the 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned other human beings as property. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people.
Question. What kind of things happened here?
Lynchings or hangings took place here on this very spot.
Black folks here in Charleston refer to it as the lynching tree.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. It is not an either or.
There must be a revolution of values in our country, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and we were seemingly, to me, at a tipping point where we were either going to roll forward with this incredible momentum on racial justice, or we could roll back. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck, and it felt like the whole thing just rolled back.
And a man grabbed me by the arm and said, "We don't allow blacks in the gym." And I remember turning to y'all and I said, "They've got a problem with the clock and with what's going on here. We all are out here. We're leaving."
I didn't know that.
I figured not.
Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the reason I'm asking us to think about this is that literally the future is at stake.
And Larry, he came out with his hands in the air and said, "Don't shoot." Put the shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger at close range.
And what I'm going to ask us to do tonight is to have a naked lunch moment with race in America. It's that moment when everyone has to take a look at what is really on the end of their fork.
If I may ask you a question, Jeff. Perhaps if Dylann Roof was educated, if he understood that he may not have gone down this path, what are your thoughts?
This is not going to be easy, but I can promise you this. It will never get easier to have an honest discussion about race in America than it is right now. Because if we wait, it is only going to get harder.
The Larry that you heard referred to in that trailer was a young man named Larry Payne, who was 6 years older than I was, and he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee the week before King was assassinated, 1 week to the day. There was a march in support of striking sanitation workers, and that march broke into violence. Larry was confronted by a police officer who put a shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger. And his memory has been one of the things that's been forgotten about the garbage strike and the movement in Memphis. So I am Jeff Robinson. and I am a criminal defense lawyer from Seattle, Washington. And you could be asking, why are you here and why are you doing this? And that would be a completely legitimate question. And this is the way I'm going to answer it. In 2011, I became a parent because my wife's younger sister, Jeannie, who lived in Queens, New York, was suffering from MS and she passed away. And her 13-year-old son, Matthew, my nephew, then became my 13-year-old son because he was being raised by Jeannie and Jeannie's mother. Jeannie passed away in April of 2011, and her mom, my wife's mom, passed away in November of 2011. So Matt lost both of his parents. His father was never in the picture, and he moved to Seattle. Now, I was terrified about being a parent because I didn't know anything about how to do that. And I was scared a lot. But I was more scared because there was a young black man that moved into my home. And my work as a criminal defense lawyer in Seattle had been for 30 or 35 years working on issues of racial justice, working on issues for clients of color, working and speaking around the country on these issues. They were very important to me, but they were academic to a certain extent until Matthew showed up on my doorstep. And I got scared. And one of the reasons I was scared is that there had been a narrative going on in America about young black men for more than a decade, and it went something like this.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heal.
Bring them to heal. As soon as you start talking about human beings like they're animals, get ready for some really bad shit to come. Because that's how we do it in America. We dehumanize people before we start to treat them as less than human. And so I was scared and I didn't know what to do, and I just started reading. And as I started reading, I was shocked. I didn't even know what I was looking for. But I started reading facts about our history in America that I had never seen before, that I had never heard before. And it was just scaring me, and it was shocking me. And it was shocking me because, as I said in that clip, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1956, and was assassinated in 1968. The civil rights movement wasn't something I read about in a book. It was what we were living when we stepped out the door of our house in the black neighborhoods in Memphis, Tennessee, every day of our lives. And yet I was reading about these facts about our history that I had never heard before. I have had one of the best educations in America. I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School, and nobody ever taught me this stuff. And so I felt humiliated. And then I felt angry because I thought, well, how come nobody taught me this? And so I thought, I'm going to forgive myself and get pissed off at my teachers, and I'll blame them. And then I thought, well, how could they have taught me if they weren't taught? And the amazing thing about this stuff is that these facts are hiding in plain sight. All you have to do is go and look, because human beings, from the time of the cave drawings in France that are 30,000 years old, human beings have a trait that has always been part of our existence. When we think we're doing something important, we write stuff down. And we keep it so people can read it later. And our history, from the time the colony started, is written down in plain fact for anybody that wants to take a look. And so I started to take a look, and I started to do these presentations about 7 or 8 years ago. And as they developed, I kept doing them, and I gave a presentation in 2017 in New York City. And one of the people in the audience was a woman named Sarah Kunstler. Is Sarah's father-in-law in the audience? Do I hear anybody? Could you stand up and introduce yourself, please?
My name is John Ferguson. I'm Sarah's
Thank you, John, for coming, and I please give him a hand. Because Sarah Kunstler is the daughter of the famed civil rights lawyer William Kunstler. And Sarah came up to me after the presentation and said, I'd like you to meet my sister Emily because we own a film company and we'd like to make a documentary about your presentation. And I thought that was the most stupid thing I had ever heard in my entire life. 1 year later, we are performing in Town Hall Theater on Broadway in New York City in front of a sold-out audience with 7 cameras filming. And since that time, we have gone across America filming interviews to put together a documentary called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. What I'm here to do tonight is to give you an idea of what this documentary will cover and to give you a sense of the arc of the documentary, because I think that's perhaps the most important thing about this film is the arc that we're trying to cover. When people talk about slavery and atrocities that have happened in our past, what we often hear is, yeah, but that was a long time ago. It doesn't have any impact on the way things are today. And that's something that I want to challenge with this film. And so what I'd like to do is to walk through 4 segments of this arc. And this won't be everything that the documentary covers, I promise you that. But it will give you a flavor for the things that I think can make America look at who we are differently and can make us take steps that we have not yet taken in our existence. This stuff was hiding in plain sight. The term white supremacy is a difficult term and an extreme term, and I think it is used, and some people feel that it might be overused. What I want you to consider is that white supremacy was one of the founding pillars of American society. Now, if you think that's an overstatement, in the documentary, we will walk through the historical documents that will lay this out clearly. But some of what you'll see is that we know in 1619 we have these records of 20 and odd enslaved people landing somewhere near Jamestown, Virginia. But did you know that by 1790, American cotton production had grown to 1.5 million pounds a year? Has anybody on the stage ever held a freshly picked piece of cotton in your hand? And I don't mean something out of an aspirin bottle, but like out of a field, no twigs. How much does it weigh? I can't tell you how many cotton balls that weigh near nothing it took to get to 1.5 million pounds, but I can tell you how many enslaved people it took, 700,000. In 171 years, America went from 20 and odd enslaved people to 700,000. And the details behind this story are part of what we will paint in the documentary with historical documents. Many people will say, if you're talking about the history of enslavement in America, you really can't talk about the colonies because that wasn't America yet. America didn't happen until we broke away from England. And what I'd like you to think about in terms of the arc of this story is that the white supremacy that was at the heart of the economic life of the colonial Americans was doubled down upon when we wrote our Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 is the three-fifths clause. Every black person in America was counted as three-fifths of a human being. If I asked people in this room before I started this presentation, what is affirmative action? Almost all of us would say, oh, those were programs of uplift in the 60s and 70s directed at the black community. And then at some point the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, that's reverse discrimination, and now there's kind of a balance. I'm not quite sure where it is. Many Americans think affirmative action started in the 1960s. Can you think of a more powerful form of affirmative action than giving one race of people the right to own another race? Article 1, Section 9, no ban on migration or importation of such persons before 1808. The word slavery, enslaved or slave, did not appear in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment. We'll get to that in a minute. Because the North understood that the South was upset by that word. It was kind of harsh. And so enslaved people were referred to as such persons. And no ban on migration meant that we need to keep the ships going to Africa to bring more enslaved people back because we are getting rich off of this. We can't cut this trade off until 1808. Article 2, Section 1. Each state shall appoint a number of electors equal to the number.
One reason.
To give the southern states a guarantee that they would have a significant role in electing the president of the United States. And here is where you will hear letters from people like Patrick Henry. Remember him, y'all? Give me liberty or give me death. Well, when the Constitutional Convention was happening, people thought they were doing something important. So they wrote stuff down. And Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet, so people had to write letters to each other. And Patrick Henry, you will see in the documentary, an actor reading Patrick Henry's letter about there are 236,000 blacks in Virginia and fewer none in the northern states. Multiply 236,000 by three-fifths and you still get a big number, especially considering the size of America at the time. This was done directly to further the interest of the slave-owning states. Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for any runaway slave must be returned on demand. And I was telling Art earlier, I've been giving this presentation or some version of it for 7 or 8 years, and I have just realized recently that this document says an incredible thing. This part of the Constitution makes it clear that from the first day that this country came into existence, America turned to its law enforcement officers and said, your job is to control, contain, and suppress every black face in America. We wrote it in the Constitution. Because if there's no freedom for a runaway, what does that mean? The United States Marshals Service is on you to bring you back to your owner. And finally, people say the folks that wrote the Constitution were brilliant, and they were. Go back to Article 1, Section 9. No state could pass a law saying you can't bring enslaved people from Africa into our state, because that would be unconstitutional. But these folks were wily. They said, what if folks try and amend the Constitution? And so they doubled down and they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until after 1808. They were going to keep those ships coming. The word slavery is mentioned once in the 13th Amendment, which did not rid America of slavery. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, shall exist within the United States. That means that slavery and involuntary servitude do exist for people who have been convicted of a crime. Think about the new Jim Crow and mass incarceration in the light of this amendment. This was not done by mistake. And the documentary will demonstrate people knew exactly what they were doing when they wrote this amendment. So I wish I could see a show of hands. How many people know who the colonial Marines were? I am trying to demonstrate how we have been deprived of the truth about our history. If you were never taught who the colonial Marines were, the colonial Marines were escaped enslaved people that fought for the British in the War of Independence and during the War of 1812. Why? Because the British said, if we win, you get your freedom. And the colonial Marines in the War of 1812 were part of British troops that attacked the Americans right outside of Washington, D.C., drove them back into Washington, D.C., and set the White House on fire. And one of the people who was watching that happen was Francis Scott Key. And 3.5 weeks later, he was in Baltimore Harbor watching the bombing of Fort McHenry. And after 25 consecutive hours of bombing, when he saw the American flag still flying, he became overcome with patriotic fervor, and he wrote the poem that became the national anthem.
And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion of home and country should leave us no more? Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No
refuge can save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight, because we will hunt you down, or the gloom of the grave, because we will put you in the dirt if you dare fight against America for your freedom. And there are historians who will be anxious to tell you, well, Francis Scott Key wasn't talking about those enslaved people. He was talking about some other enslaved people. Francis Scott Key was a virulent racist. Francis Scott Key prosecuted a man in Washington, D.C. after the Civil War for possessing abolitionist literature, which carried the death penalty. Francis Scott Key called black Americans the worst plight to ever be inflicted on America. This is who wrote our national anthem, and these are the words. We may not sing them anymore, but they're there. And if you didn't know this, I wonder what you might think of black athletes who kneel quietly protesting racial injustice, knowing that this is our national anthem. And in the documentary, we will use all kinds of evidence to demonstrate just how much America relied on enslaving people. But this is an example of what it was about. The 1856 unique defense to the charge of murder that was put forward on behalf of Margaret Garner. And what Margaret Garner did is best described by a newspaper article from the Cincinnati Enquirer from 1856.
Great excitement existed throughout the city the whole day of yesterday in consequence of the arrest of a party of slaves and the murder of her child by a slave mother while officers were in the act of making the arrest. A party of 17 slaves escaped from Boone and Kenton counties in Kentucky about 16 miles from the Ohio on Sunday night last, and taking with them two horses and a sled, drove that night to the Ohio River opposite to Western Row in this city. Leaving the horses and sled standing there, they crossed the river on foot,
across the river,
on the ice, on foot, on the ice.
One of the narratives in America that has been very popular is that, yes, slavery was a bad thing, but it wasn't that bad. There were like good living conditions, and they had good food, and they were treated okay. Just how bad does it have to be for you to take your family and cross the Ohio River in the middle of the winter, on foot, on the ice, not knowing if the ice will break for you to fall through? It was bad enough that Margaret Garner and her family took that risk. And when the U.S. Marshals showed up the next day in Cincinnati to arrest her, as the Constitution required them to do, Margaret Garner took a knife, grabbed her daughter, and slit her throat. Then she went after her sons, and the marshals got to her before she could complete her task. This is an oil painting, a rendering of what Margaret Garner did, experienced, and Alfre Woodard helped us with reading that poem at the event in Town Hall in New York.
Then, said the mournful mother, if Ohio cannot save, I will do a deed for freedom. She shall find each child a grave. I will save my precious children from their darkly threatened doom. I will hew their path to freedom through the portals of the tomb. A moment in the sunlight, she held a glimmering knife. The next moment she had bathed it in the crimson fount of life. They snatched away the fatal knife. Her boys shrieked, wild with dread. The baby girl was pale and cold. They raised it up. The child was dead. Send this deed for fearful daring through my country's heart. No thrill. Do the icy hands of slavery every pure emotion chill?
Like this. This is what slavery was. It wasn't something else. This is who we are as Americans when we talk about our history, because Margaret Garner was charged with first-degree murder for killing her daughter. And the murder charges were dismissed. Because in order to be convicted of first-degree murder, you have to kill a human being. And what Margaret Garner killed was an enslaved child. So Margaret Garner, her husband, and her three sons were returned to their owners to live out the rest of the Civil War.
And we are still dealing with this debate. 57% of Americans saying that Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride. Well, let's remember, that flag disappeared until 1948, and who brought it back? Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrat Party. And what was their platform? We stand for segregation of the races. They knew what this flag stood for.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war. That was not the cause of the Southern states seceding. That was not the cause of the first shot being fired on that fort over there. It was about money. And it was not about slavery. It was about moral terrorists. It was about more money. Lincoln wanted to impose 45% more taxes on the Southern states.
Taxes on the goods the Southern states were producing. And those goods were essentially cotton, tobacco, and rice.
Slavery had nothing to do.
And those goods were produced by slave labor. All of it. Isn't that right?
I mean, the
95% of it? Isn't that right? If it's 95% produced by slave labor, enslaved people, and the North is saying, we're going to tax you on that because we want some of that money, and the South is saying, no, wait a minute, we're the ones producing it, so you shouldn't be taking the money. That money wouldn't exist without slave labor. I mean, that did affect the bottom line. Wouldn't you agree with that?
They chose to stay. In most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people treated as family? Then why wouldn't it be all right for me to own you as long as I treated you like family?
If that's the way economics work?
Would you be satisfied with that?
In today's world.
In any world.
In today's time?
In any time.
Charleston, South Carolina was the port through which almost 40% of every African-American enslaved person that came to this country came through. This is on the waterfront in Charleston, South Carolina. These men are there demonstrating every weekend, every Sunday. Cars drive by, beep horns, yell out words of encouragement, and their view is that the Civil War had nothing to do with enslaving people and that enslaved people were treated as family. This conversation was difficult because literally the day before we had been to the Charleston Slave Mart Museum. And trust me, this is not how family was treated.
We are standing in front of the Chalmers Street entrance of the Old Slave Mart Museum. This structure and this complex was created as a response to the outdoor sale of enslaved populations within the city of Charleston. By the 1850s, the outdoor sale of enslaved people that had been going on since the founding of the colony in 1670 was being seen as somewhat of an aberrant eyesore. Now, what is a large parking lot behind this building today was originally a massive pen that contained a four-story jail building utilized to house enslaved people prior to the day of sale. There was a two-story kitchen building back there for nutritional needs, as well as prepping the enslaved, and a morgue building, or more accurately, a dead house, for sick and dying enslaved. They would sell enslaved people out of this location 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. Everyone from newborns to 70-year-olds were sold out of here. For enslaved people to make the most money for the traders and for the sellers, they have to be prepped first. Prep could be everything from high-fat and high-protein diets to get them into better physical shape, as well as, you know, fresh clothing. You have the sort of prepping of the skin through oiling. If they're looking a little bit older, they could either dye the hair or pluck any grays that someone would have, things of that nature, in order to, when they come up onto the block, they're able to garner the largest amount of money.
And I'm looking at a list of Negroes,
mm-hmm.
and it says, number one, the name is Sunday, the age is 45.
Enslaved people, they didn't have last names generally until the 1870 census. And so it was the question of, what is your name?
Because the names could be changed each time you were sold?
They would be changed. That's the first thing that is changed every time you're sold. So on all broadsides you will ever see, this is just the name they come to the sale with. And keep in mind that the enslaved property of slave owners was worth more than everything else they owned. It was worth more than the plantation. It was more than the land, more than the goods that are produced on that plantation, more than the house, more than any other liveries that they have. So the first thing that's going to be sold to pay for a debt is, you know, enslaved. Because you didn't have to buy them outright. You could mortgage them. So this is representative of a pricing chart. There are four factors that define how much an enslaved person is ultimately sold for. The first is age. The younger you are, because it's a future investment, the more valuable you are. Also, there's something called prime. It was enslaved individuals from about the age of 10 to 12 to the age of about 25. For males, it was the amount of work they can do in that time. You're very strong, you're very virile. And for females, it's the amount of children they can produce. And so you have the subcategories based on age, skills, health, and skin tone. And so when it came to movement of enslaved prior to being brought onto that block, they're going to be chained.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone's going to be chained. It's not just going to be grown-ups. It's not going to be the elderly. It'll also be the children.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. And And again, you know, as I mentioned, that blacksmithing was a job that enslaved people would do. They could be in charge of making shackles.
Let's go upstairs.
Sure.
Well, how hard is it for you to work here and do this every day? Because it has to take a toll.
It does. It does.
I get that.
Yeah. But I'm also really lucky. This is a physical aspect of control. This is the end piece of a very large whip. It was originally about 6 feet long. And if you look very closely, there are braided bits,
yes,
nails driven into the leather wrap. And that would act as a way to both, stiffen it, but also to bite into the skin.
Ista, I would like to ask, what are the three holes that I see in these bricks in the walls there?
They're fingerprints. Enslaved people would begin to learn a skill at the age of about six.
Mm-hmm.
And so fingerprints and handprints and thumbprints exist all throughout the city because enslaved people built the city. As you can see, my fingers don't fit because this brick was not made by an adult.
It was made by a child.
Yes. Yes. And so on churches, on businesses, in alleyways, you see these in theaters. You see these all throughout the city in very, very subtle ways. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you may not see them.
But they're there.
Absolutely. And they are a way of the enslaved who created this city and created the economy that created this country to remind us, hey, I was here too.
That is an example of what we are going to try and do with the time period from colonial times to the Civil War. And one of the things that Art and I were talking about earlier is that we talked about America's reaction to things like when the movie Roots came out, and when other things have come out. And America has, it seems like for a moment, looked and said, my God, that's really horrible, and then moved on. And part of it is because I think we have been insufficient in making, or we have not worked hard enough to make the connections from 1619 to 2020. And part of the purpose of this documentary is to try and make those connections, to say to people there is a direct and unbroken line from the white supremacy that let the colonial Americans get rich by bringing enslaved people from Africa to the white supremacy that exists today. And if that unbroken line can be established, I think you get people to a different place. The end of the connection to the Civil War. By 1861, remember in 1790, 1.5 million pounds of cotton a year? By 1861, it was 2.3 billion pounds a year. 60% of all U.S. exports. Folks, this is how America got rich. The number of enslaved people was now 4 million. I'm not saying, let's be clear, that America enslaved 4 million people between 1619 and 1861. It was much, much more than that. I'm saying there were 4 million alive in 1861. The value of enslaved people in 1861, $3.5 billion, more than all the money in circulation in America at the time, and worth more than $100 billion in today's money. The richest part of America, most millionaires per capita, the Mississippi Valley, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, one of the poorest places in America today because the labor of enslaved people has never been replaced in those economies. And understand, enslaved people were more than just free labor. You had to buy them, and so you take out a loan, and you have to pay interest on the loan. You had to take out insurance policies. The sales were taxed and notarized. Everybody was making this money. And so let's skip forward, because the documentary will not do the skipping. We will cover more area after the Civil War. But let's skip forward to the first half of the 20th century, and I want to talk about the Tulsa Massacre. I guarantee you, many, many, many Americans learned about the Tulsa Massacre from watching something called The Watchmen on HBO. And what I'll say that's great and bad about that, on the one hand, I can't believe it takes a cartoon movie for America to learn about one of the worst mass killings in our history. On the other hand, if that's what informed people and they now know about it, at least they now know. The Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was one of the richest neighborhoods in America in 1921. I didn't say one of the richest black neighborhoods in America. I said one of the richest neighborhoods in America. 1921, there were businesses, churches, restaurants, grocery stores, movie theaters, private airplanes. There was a hospital. There was a post office. There were schools, libraries, a law office. They even had a bus system. On May 31st, 1921, a young black man was arrested for supposedly assaulting a white woman. And you can go back and look at the newspapers, even that were written then. And at most, this young man bumped into this woman and she screamed. The narrative in the black community, of course, is that they were involved with each other and they were kissing, and another white person walked into the elevator and she had to scream. At any rate, this young man was arrested and taken down to the jail. And a lynch mob was formed. But what they forgot was that the black men in the Greenwood area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had served in World War I, and they still had their long rifles, and they were trained in military efficiency. And they came down and surrounded the courthouse and kept the lynch mob out. Not one white person was injured that night. A shot was fired when there was a scuffle over a gun, a white man saying to one of the black men, "Boy, what are you going to do with that gun?" And the black man responding, "Use it if I have to." The lynch mob was turned away, and the next day, the Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned to the ground. Many people think it was a street, Black Wall Street. It was 4 square miles that were burned to the ground. And in doing our research, we came across in an old Fox movie tone file actual footage that was filmed on June 1st, 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
So here I am. Truly what's really happening. Make it like it was the way it used to be when I hungered for your
times, and you never know when you'll need a lawyer. Introducing Legal Shield. Get legal help 24/7. For over 47 years, people from all walks of life have joined our community and our mission to empower and protect. Wait, there's more! Become a sales associate and watch your commission grow with every sale. We are working together to change the negatives into positives. Business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major corporations all across the globe. We focus on business education, advertising, so that everyone can see the return on their investment. Visit our website at robinsonir38.wearelegalshield.com. Or for more information, contact Dr. Ron Robinson at 914-363-9007 or 203-515-7167 or 914-530-5876. Again, visit us at our website at www.robinsonr38.wearelegalshield.com.
Seems like you can't make it through. Child, you
After you've gone through the rain.